Welcome to the Learning Well podcast, where we take learning seriously, but not ourselves.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Learning Well. Today, we're doing something a little different. Today is the first of two parts, and we're going to be having a book discussion. I will do a book this episode and then another book. So we've had some pretty smart guests the last few weeks and some pretty heady topics, but we're rolling into summer now. So in summer in Michigan is beautiful, long summer days, relaxing at barbecues and beach reads. So on these next two episodes, we're going to be joined by a couple guests and we're going to be discussing a book that we would recommend to our learning community to read over the summer. So I'm excited about that. I'm excited to jump into two different books that we recommend you could take to the beach. But first, let's meet our guests. Cade, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Perfect. Yeah, really nice to be on the podcast with you. My name is Cade Wilson. I am a solutions architect at Mindspring. I have a little bit about myself before we kind of
absolutely
move on.
We want to hear it.
I have a background in history and French, and then I went on to grad school, and I actually have a degree in ethnic and immigration studies, and I worked my research regarded policy that discriminated against certain communities in the United States. So that's a little bit about my background in that sense from academia. I got the opportunity to spend some time living overseas. And so that was really, for me, that was like a really formative time in helping me learn how to rethink my assumptions
Absolutely.
And my biases.
Yeah.
And that played a pretty big role in my life. So I give all that background because it's pretty related to the topic that we're going to be talking about today.
For sure.
Well, and Cade is one of my favorite. We have a lot of book discussions and not on the podcast, but just in general. So, and I would agree. In fact, your background is one of the best arguments for not looking at just a resume, but bringing someone in and talking with them because
his resume wasn't that good.
I did not say that. When you look at it, and you think, how is this person interested in being an instructional designer or solutions architect? And you are a fantastic addition to our team. Mm-hmm. So we're looking forward to your thoughts here in just a few minutes. And Jeff.
Yeah, thank you, Miriam. My name is Jeff Helmes. I'm a marketing manager. I would say a lifelong learner, like most of us, but went to college for a lot of different things, changed my major a bunch, ended up in a broadcasting production position, but I have a wide background in digital media. And so I have a pretty broad perspective on news information, how you intake it and where you source it from. So
Jeff, as many of you know, is the producer for this show, but we are very excited to have him as the guest for this show too. And when he heard we were doing this book, he jumped in. And so we're excited to hear, I think with your background too, I think it'll bring a good fresh perspective as well.
Thank you.
So the book we're choosing to discuss is Adam Grant's Think Again, which has been out since 2021. And I know it's a popular book, but we wanted to take a look at it specifically as it pertains to learning communities. You might not think of this as a beach read. My criteria, I don't know about you guys, my criteria for a beach read means I don't need a pen to take notes. I don't need to mark the book up. I can put it down and go get in the water and come back and pick up. Like, I don't have to think about it. I know where I'm at. Mm-hmm. So I think this book kind of fits both categories. My current copy is marked up everywhere, like dog-eared, underlined, multiple colors. But he uses so many great stories that it's also really interesting. And you can put it down and pick it up and kind of figure out where you're at.
Yep.
So that's why we think it qualifies.
For sure.
So we've split our discussion today into several parts. So first, we want to kind of give you an overview, those of you listening to the book. Because if you don't have an overview, you're not going to understand what we're talking about. But then we're going to jump into several, obviously we're not going to review all the chapters, but several key chapters and kind of our thinking on it. So
awesome.
To begin, I'm just going to read a couple short paragraphs right from the book jacket because I think it gives an overview. And then you guys chime in, what we've missed, whatever here. But so he says, intelligence is usually seen as the ability to think and learn. But in a rapidly changing world, there's another set of cognitive skills that might matter more, the ability to rethink and unlearn. In our daily lives, too many of us favor the comfort of conviction over the discomfort of doubt. We listen to opinions that make us feel good instead of ideas that make us think hard. We see disagreement as a threat to our egos rather than an opportunity to learn. And we surround ourselves with people who agree with our conclusions when we should be gravitating towards those who challenge our thought process. The result is that our beliefs get brittle long before our bones. We think too much like preachers defending our sacred beliefs, prosecutors proving the other side wrong, and politicians campaigning for approval, and too little like scientists searching for the truth. Intelligence is no cure, and it can even be a curse. being good at thinking can make us worse at rethinking, which is, I think, a really interesting thought. The brighter we are, the blinder we are to our own limitations. So that's a really good, I think that sets the stage for it. And the book really is divided into four parts. So it starts with individual rethinking, which is kind of updating and rethinking our own views. Then interpersonal rethinking, in other words, working with others to help sort of open their minds. And then collective rethinking, which is creating communities of lifelong learners. And then a conclusion, which sounds very weighty and heavy. The book is 307 pages long, but like the last 40 pages are all notes and epilogues. So it's actually
doesn't
really
feel that way.
Yeah. So what have I missed, guys? Like, if you were going to give an overview.
Well, I would also say, as like a beach read, I feel like it is something you can pick up and put down a lot, but I got quite involved in it because of the stories. So there's quite a few stories. It seemed like a mix of self-help and then going back into stories that kind of help you relate that idea and then going back to a new topic. So
yeah, the stories were really helpful.
I was just going to say, one of the things that I measure a beach read by is whether or not, so I have a number of people in my orbit that don't love to read.
Right.
And
right.
So if this is something that I would recommend to them, that's typically like a beach read. And for me, in my interests, like, hey, dad, you don't love to read usually, but you might really like this book. Mm-hmm. So you should check it out. Like that kind of, to me, it feels very much, very universal, like anybody could enjoy and find value in it.
And anyone can apply this. This is not someone you have to be interested in fantasy or romance or even just so this is anyone can apply this today.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the comments I'll save to the end. But he does a great job of sort of pulling in information from a lot of places. So rather than having to go read seven different books, you can read it here.
Yep.
But then his unique twist to apply things, I think, is what makes it useful. And it doesn't really matter what walk of life you're in or what industry you're in. It's easy to apply. So, all right. Well, that's a short, very short summary. Obviously, we encourage you to read it. But if you're wondering why we also chose it, like we talked about beach read, but if you're wondering why we chose it kind of for a learning podcast, we understand that from learning science, there's a lot more to this concept of like thinking and how we do it, the world of upskilling, which are reskilling, such a huge buzzword in our industry right now. So the book is timely. It's timely from a world events standpoint. I mean, he just spends a lot of time talking about our world is deeply polarized, and he spends a lot of time talking about how we can learn to interact with people that we don't agree with, and that's okay, but how we can figure out how to create more nuanced, complex conversations. So that's from our standpoint, I think, why we also felt it was super useful. And then also at the end, he'll spend time talking about building communities of learners and lifelong learners. And so anyone that's in the learning industry, no matter what industry you're in, you're desiring to do that with the group of team members, employees, the people in your organization. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we obviously can't discuss it all. So let's get to it, though. Right. Enough of the previews. The first section of the book, Individual Rethinking. So Grant explains several different obstacles that prevent us from being good rethinkers personally. Mm-hmm. And the way that he does this is he begins by helping us sort of look at ourselves in a new light. Sometimes it's really helpful to have like this mental schema of how I fit in. And when I'm having a disagreement with someone, how do I choose to act? Mm-hmm. And so he basically talks about when we enter into a controversial discussion, we usually assume the persona of like three different professions. So what are those professions? And tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, so I can run through those for you. First of all, I like that they all start with P. Is that an alliteration?
An alliteration.
It is an alliteration. Good alliteration. There we go, yeah.
So
Jeff nailing it.
Yeah. I know.
The first one, preacher. When our values or beliefs are at stake, we give sermons to defend or promote our ideas. Prosecutor. When seeing flaws in other people's thinking, we use arguments to prove them wrong and win. And a politician, when we want to win people over, we focus on winning approval at the expense of all else. And then they later talk about a fourth. I don't know if you want to go into that right now.
Nope, hold on. Okay. You're doing great. We're getting there.
Yeah. Chill out, Jeff.
I'm so excited. I like the fourth.
I know, right? Anything to add to that, Kate, in terms of preacher, prosecutor, or politician?
Not at this point. I mean, I once we get into it, I think there's a lot to say about each of these different different categories. But no, Jeff, I think that was a great overview.
And I like how they use the terms. Like, there's an actual preacher, prosecutor, politician. Those are jobs. Those are roles. They already have a function. So it's really easy for me to relate. Okay, yeah, I'm being a preacher right now. Like, I can definitely tell I'm doing that. Or I'm prosecuting right now. So I like that they put those into those three buckets.
And it's interesting because each of those three categories, they're not inherently bad things.
No, right, right.
Right? They're kind of like
they're how they communicate too, almost. Those jobs communicate a very specific way.
Yeah, yeah. You know, so there's a lot of like really positive attributes, but you can easily pivot towards a different approach, a different method there. Mm-hmm. And totally embody a whole different persona when it comes to particular situations. Mm-hmm.
We're jumping in.
Yeah. You know, so as like an individual, you can oscillate between a preacher or a politician, depending on the situation. Yes. So you're not, Jeff isn't the preacher. Miriam's not the prosecutor. You know, you move within one conversation between those, depending on how the goalposts move.
For sure.
Well, and who you're interacting with, because I think, like you mentioned, I think it's important to say, too, these all have good characteristics. You know, people are passionate about their beliefs and they're important. They're going to preach about it. Or if you're interacting with someone that has very clear, like, holes in their argument, you prosecute. You want to identify those, and you want people as a politician to approve of what's happening. And I think you're right. We all pivot between those depending on the type of situation. Mm-hmm. But I mean, we're already jumping right into it. So these can obviously cause issues, right? Because we're not rethinking. We are sticking with what we know. And so he introduces a fourth profession. So I'm gonna let Jeff go ahead, since you're already halfway there. What does he advocate for instead?
Yeah, it's kind of like the combination of all, or looking at all of those views as a scientist, where we accept how little we know. We form hypotheses, run experiments, and consistently rethink our understanding of the world and others based on new knowledge. So really, it's just constantly reevaluating, stepping back, thinking, testing. Like, I love the scientist approach because I love testing and poking holes in things. And I'm a very devil's advocate. Like, that's my one of my favorite things in terms as a marketing person. When we're coming up with ideas, my first instinct is to shoot it down, which is probably a negative thing.
Maybe prosecutor. I don't know.
I mean it out of love. Like, right. If I can't shoot this down, this is a great idea. Mm-hmm. So I really like the whole scientist approach.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little section in here that talks about the difference between beliefs and values. And I feel like this idea of like a scientific approach, scientific methodology and all this. I had a recent conversation with a prospective client even about the difference between these beliefs and values, and how we are really getting into their needs and what their outcomes were, what they're looking for in their outcomes, and really learning, is this something that is a value in the organization that will stay the same in 2 years? Or is this a belief that could change in 3 months, 4 months, 5 months as new data comes into that system and you're outputting, it's okay to oscillate a little bit in that regard. But that scientific methodology really allows you to kind of move in between that liminal space of not feeling like you're having to constantly dig your heels into something. You're allowing data to come in, Jeff, like what you're saying, and then the output can change over time.
Yeah, being active versus static, basically.
Well, and we'll talk later when we get to his third section of the book, but there are some, when you start talking about organizations, as you were, that gets tricky too, because you might have that mindset, but the six other people sitting around the table might not, which can cause, but that is then again where we get into really what we're talking about now, this individual situation of they're not willing to sort of live in this limbo situation. So how do I interact with them now? But prosecutor, preacher, politician, and then he advocates. There's actually several chapters where he's giving examples and advocating for why it's more important to be a scientist. So one of the interesting things after Grant discusses sort of this preacher, prosecutor, politician, and scientist is, I mean, okay, that's great. Like, we can create these artificial constructs which help us understand how we interact in situations, but there's real science behind that. And one of the things he tackles then is sort of this feeling of one of the reasons that we often fall into these is because we're either overconfident or underconfident based on our knowledge. So that ties into the Dunning-Kruger effect, which is a very interesting scientific sort of concept. So I know, Cade, you you know, you've spent some time talking about this. There's a mount of stupid, which I always find interesting. And I always wonder at times when I'm talking with people or myself, if I'm sitting on Mount Stupid right now.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about how he unpacks that concept?
How Grant explains it is he talks about it in terms of this XY coordinate, where the Y coordinate is the willingness a person has to talk about a subject. And then the X coordinate is the knowledge of that subject. And so a lot of times the Dunning-Kruger effect says that somebody's knowledge of that topic might be low, but their willingness to talk about that thing might be really high. You know, a common case study for this is where somebody reads one article on the internet, and then they think now that they're an expert, and they want to share with everybody.
Or even like the obvious and easy example, armchair quarterbacking, Like the guy sitting in the chair yelling at the TV on a Sunday afternoon.
Should have thrown it outside. Don't run the ball.
Right. Yeah. Willingness to talk about it has zero actual expertise.
Mm-hmm. And so I personally got a sense of this a ton. So a number of years ago, I had the chance to run for state representative here in Michigan. And as a political candidate, one of the things that a lot of people were coming to us and coming to me and asking me to opine on something that my knowledge of that thing might have been pretty low.
Right.
And I probably should not have talked about those things. And I think that that's an interesting, like for me, that's why this is so important, is that there are a lot of spaces where we hold these roles or people or positions up on a pedestal. And what we're constantly asking them to do is to live on Mount Stupid.
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's that point of where somebody knows very little about something, but they talk about it all day long. And what we really want is somebody that's a little farther down that. When I was in the political campaign, somebody gave me some advice that was really, really helpful for me. And she said, to be successful at this, you have to have a healthy dose of humility and hubris.
Right. Mm. No, that's great.
And I find that a similar continuum as to this. It's different, obviously, but you know, we want to make sure that as we're thinking through and learning content, learning anything really, that we're not living on Mount Stupid where we think we're immediately an expert because we read a thing about something.
He really is arguing for pretty much everything that's counterculture, like nuance, understanding there's complexity to issues, confident, who, you know, all those kinds of things, being confident, but yet being humble. Most of those things are fairly counterculture, you know, the 140 word Twitter limit, the sound bites. But that is sort of an underlying big theme throughout the book. And he starts unpacking that by looking at these first, like when we get into arguments or disagreements with people, we almost all default to that because that's right. How our culture is. But we don't want to really sit atop Mount Stupid. Nobody does. Mm-hmm. So
you got to start to enjoy being wrong.
Or the willingness to say, I don't know.
Yes.
Yep.
And I think especially in the business that we're in, there's a natural desire to want to help either our clients or the people in the organization that we're working with. And sure, like it's better to say, I'm not sure. I will do some research, or I will try to figure that out for you, instead of the sort of surfacey, yep, I got the answer to that, because that doesn't help anyone.
When we were talking earlier a little bit about like digging into something when you're committed to a viewpoint or perspective, but Jeff, as you were talking about like collecting more data, if we're digging in, Mount Stupid is not a fixed height.
Right.
That mountain can continue to grow and build over time, where your knowledge actually is never increasing, but your willingness to opine about it continues to get higher. The elevation keeps raising.
Confidence.
I love that. I mean, I don't love it, but I love your comment on that. It's very true. I think we could spend a lot of time talking about this. And really what we want to do is encourage people to dig into those. Those are really the first four chapters of this book. But then we move on. And section two, I think, is, I would say, once you sort of have a clear idea of who you are as a person and how you interact, and that was why Grant starts there, right? Is section two talks about how we interact with other people. So he calls it interpersonal rethinking, opening other people's minds. Now, when he says opening other people's minds, that's not, again, as a preacher, politician, or prosecutor. But in particular, I think there's chapter seven. He talks a lot about motivational interviewing and asking questions to help understand people's motivations better. And this is not a prosecutorial, why'd you do that? What'd you do that for? Why do you believe that? But it's much more of a asking with the motivation of wanting to understand more. So he talks quite a bit in chapter eight about how we depolarize divided discussions. How do we avoid binary thinking? What are the main takeaways you guys had from those chapters, and what are some sort of specific things we could do?
I can start with some of the motivational interviewing parts. Some of the techniques I saw with motivational interviewing was asking open-ended questions, engaging in reflective listening, affirming the person's desire and ability to change. It's a way of offering others our attention, basically.
Yes.
And I think that's probably the most important part, is they're just looking for that time of day, that attention, and not being told what to do, but maybe just hearing them out.
That's the biggest. I mean, and if you go to any communication skills training, all of the popular self-help, I mean, as a society, we don't listen well to people at all. We're always formulating our next response, which is prosecutor, preacher, or politician at that point, and then affirming their desire to change. And those two things are exactly what you said, Jeff. Really, all you're doing is saying to this person, you have value. I might not agree with you, but you have value in my eyes, and I appreciate that. And I'm going to listen to you, and I'm going to affirm the fact that you have a different opinion than me, but it's more nuanced, and I'm willing to listen to that, even if at the end of the day, we don't completely agree. And I mean, that sounds so simple, but it just doesn't happen very often in our society. Obviously, you can see, like, this is a great relationship book, too, right? This applies to significant others and family and friends, and, I mean, not just workplaces or organizations.
Anyone you talk to.
Exactly.
Yeah, and something that's really interesting with that, with, like, the line of questioning, when you look at some of the greatest thinkers in history and, you know, greatest leaders even today, one of their greatest assets is that they constantly ask questions. And they do it, I find, to both learn what the other perspective truly is, with Jeff, like, that open-ended, you know, question, but also asking questions really can lead to an uncovering of cognitive dissonance within people's perspectives too, where you're, you know, Socrates was well known for that, right? Asking questions that leads to this dissonance in somebody's perspective where, hey, oh, now that I'm talking through it, maybe it doesn't make complete sense. Great. You discovered that on your own.
Yep.
And so as somebody who's asking questions, you can kind of help do both of those things, you know, maybe not necessarily as, like, targeted and intentional to help them uncover that.
Right.
But by doing that, you know, asking questions, it does help us think, kind of brings us back to the first chapter. It helps somebody get into that introspective point of view.
By asking those questions, we can often also uncover gaps in our own thinking, too. Or even just, I've never thought of that perspective based on where I come from or the experiences I've had. But you have to ask those questions with the true desire to listen.
Well, one of the things when I was reading this section of the book, that a question was, how do we ever discover that we do have disagreement with somebody? Right? Like, unless we're asking questions, unless we're all just opining, how do we actually learn or discover that we do have disagreement or a disconnect in terms of our perspective on something?
Well, and we've all met people that opine all day long and they assume you have the exact same opinion, but you don't really ever have a chance to get a word in edgewise when it's usually starts, well, actually, but
Ross
they just
Keller.
Made this assumption, right? That everything, you all believe the same way.
Yeah, I don't know if we're in chapter 8 yet, but I'm kind of jumping.
You can go ahead.
There. I'm jumping.
Let's head there.
You know, in chapter 8, when he's talking about these people that can go into this almost like a war room where they, like, can combat with ideas or have disagreements, and they're really trying to, they go in having read something about a topic, and then they go in, and the goal is to try to come out with alignment. I found that really fascinating, from the sense of, how often do we, when we're interacting with other people, assume that there's disagreement,
right?
And we are assuming that we're trying to convince instead of creating alignment. Like, how big of a perspective shift that truly is if every interaction you're having with somebody is, man, like, I really want to create alignment with you.
Right. What do we agree about?
Yeah.
But that's, I think, rethinking. Like, that's kind of the essence. And I mean, if I had to sort of summarize his whole section here, you know, the key to depolarization really is understanding there's complexity and nuance in this world, and trying to figure out with that person or that group that you feel like you don't agree with or whatever, like, understanding the bigger issues and the other side of the story, being empathetic. It doesn't necessarily mean you are going to agree, but recognizing, like you said, we have some things we align on, and then this issue is far more complex and nuanced than what we want to, you know, we normally would give credit to.
And it's what we seek out. We seek out disagreement often more than agreement or alignment or understanding.
Yes. Social media is a dumpster fire of seeking out disagreement.
A little dumpster fire.
Oh, yeah, it reminds us that there are no best or most effective behaviors. They all have consequences.
Oh, for sure. So I think one of the interesting things is if you're listening to this podcast, you're kind of maybe getting the idea, the concept of like, oh, we just need to be exposed to other people's conversations, hear what they think, or dig a little deeper, do some research, and then, oh, we're going to change our mind, which I'm going to come to that at the end, because I do have sort of a, in the back of my head, kind of question about the whole book. But he makes the point that just exposure to other ideas isn't really enough. So, Cade, what I know that was kind of an important topic as you were reading through it and thinking about it.
Yeah, I just like that idea from, we think that if I have my idea, my perspective, my opinion, if somebody else, Jeff, you share your opinion with me, that's going to better help me come out to a better output, a better conclusion. But Miriam, as you were saying, social media is a dumpster fire, right?
Right.
We don't need more exposure right. to opinions necessarily. What he talks about is like increasing complexity mm-hmm. leads to less black and white paradigms, mm-hmm. less polarization, and more of that like gray space where it really forces us to kind of rethink and recraft our own perspective. So in some way, it seems like it's presenting more views and perspectives, but it's actually just more nuance and complexity to those perspectives.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's advocating for, like you said, maybe not more exposure, better exposure, meaning like mm-hmm. the quality of what I'm reading. I'm not taking my sound bites off Twitter. Yeah. I'm reading a research article, and mm-hmm. then I'm taking the time to reflect myself on, I guess I hadn't thought about that. I didn't see that research. So my mind has maybe changed in this area, or my mind hasn't changed, but I understand this issue better now, and I can better articulate why it is that I don't hold that opinion mm-hmm. or whatever, which I do love your viewpoint, because there is more exposure all the time. I mean, like Jeff, what you said, that's the biggest issue. It's the biggest issue working with K-12 students right now. How in the world do you help them? Like, there's so much out there. It's learning how to be critical consumers of it. And that starts at a very young age. So the third section really of the book talks a lot about creating kind of communities of culture where we're rethinking as a community. And he calls the section collective rethinking, creating communities of lifelong learning. But in particular, chapter 10, I love it's called, "That's Not the Way We've Always Done It, Building Cultures of Learning at Work." And boy, that phrase resonates 100%, mm-hmm. right? So I think to me, we're often asked in the work that we do, well, what does a culture of learning look like? And mm-hmm. our answer, standard answer is, well, you have one, whether you know it or not. It's mm-hmm. a good one or a bad one. If you don't know that you have it, it's probably not great. But he really kind of steps back a little bit and talks more about like the types of work cultures mm-hmm. and that there are out there and whether those have a positive or a negative impact on learning mm-hmm. in the workplace. Mm-hmm. He talks about a performance culture versus a psychologically safe culture.
Yep.
So how does he, what's the difference there? What are those two cultures like?
The psychological safety is when people can express their concerns or suggestions while knowing they'll be well received. Whereas the opposite in like a performance culture, it's much more reliant on experts to trust their word instead of rethinking the approach. So I really love this chapter. Just the question, you know, asking, how do you know? Mm-hmm. I just love mm-hmm. that idea just on everything. It's almost like a kid asking.
Yeah. Why?
But like, how do you know? Like, I would love proof. It goes back to that mm-hmm. scientific approach. Like, show me the proof. Where is your work? You know, that's the answer, but where is your work? Mm-hmm. So I think that helps me at least get my own understanding of whatever that topic is.
Well, and he even advocates for saying too, sometimes like actually by saying, show me proof, you're jumping back into a different role. And that's not necessarily the question, show me the proof, but it's how do you know, meaning being like frank, non-judgmental. Mm-hmm. And someone might even be say like, I don't have the proof yet, but I don't think this is right. And I need the space to try and figure out why. And then to go and I do want to point out the interesting thing is too, he's not talking, when we talk about a psychologically safe, he's not saying we're somehow like relaxing standards that people don't have to meet certain minimum standards. I mean, the doctor that's operating on me, I want him to or her to have specific like standards mm-hmm. they have to be held to. I don't want them to feel psychologically safe when we're done to say, I think I messed that up. Could we open her back up and try and figure it out? Like, no. He's not talking about that. Or like giving yeah. unearned praise or excessive praise for no reason. He's not talking, but he's talking about a group organizational culture where yeah. we can feel safe to say, I am not sure. Actually, I'd like to rethink that. I think we might be wrong here.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a really cool, we actually had a podcast about motivators.
Yeah, yeah.
Black hat
yeah.
motivators, yes, white hat motivators. And one of that fits very squarely into this in terms of fitting into an organizational culture and how do we rethink what's motivating us to do our work a certain way? What's motivating us to rethink or not rethink? You know, that sense of protection. I need to protect my career. So I need yeah. to prove my worth. I need to perform a certain way is really a black hat motivator.
It sure is.
It is protecting my domain, my little tend my own garden. And if I can prove my value, even at the expense yes. of other people within the organization, that's maybe not the most ideal situation.
And I think it's too often a lot of organizations' mm-hmm. cultures. They're based on that performance mm-hmm. culture for sure. Mm-hmm.
And not to give too much of the book away, but that example with the Melinda Gates, it was a scenario where they would have these annual calls and a lot of the executive teams would come on the calls to pitch, what was it, their annual spend or their ideas. Mm-hmm. And they were worried that some of them were not really pushing that hard or coming up with big ideas for the fear of failure or because there's no performance metrics to that. Mm-hmm. And they came in and tried to help them rethink and get them more comfortable with giving out maybe moonshot ideas or ideas that would fail. And in doing that, they had Melinda express some faults of her own. Or if you've seen the Jimmy Kimmel, what is it, Celebrities Read Mean Tweets?
Oh, yeah.
Had her do that and just read stuff about her to kind of open her up and make her look more vulnerable. And she's a human mm-hmm. with faults and is doing mm-hmm. her best. And I think that helps other people that are looking up to those people in leadership also realize that they're just humans, that they're a work in progress, that they mm-hmm. don't know everything. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a really cool part of this section.
Well, because that's a fatal flaw in performance thinking. And again, I'm not advocating for like lowering standards, whatever, but the long-term fatal flaw of performance thinking or performance only culture is that at some point you will completely squelch and destroy any creativity or innovation. Mm-hmm. So you might be great for the next 5 years because your metrics are good. You keep it on, but nobody's encouraged to think outside the box. Nobody's encouraged, like you said, for those moonshot ideas. At some point, that will destroy your organization because you don't have, now you're just scrambling to like keep your small sliver of the pie that everybody else, you haven't jumped
innovative.
Ahead. You're not innovative in any way.
Yeah.
If I was going to add one other thing, I think I would probably mention the reframing of best practices to better practices.
Yeah.
And I know we were talking about, you know, there's a space and a place for best practices when something is generally tried and true, but that doesn't mean it's not open to change mm-hmm. through new data. But I love this idea of better practices, really lending our interactions with different things to say and acknowledge like there just may be a better way to do this. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I would say that when best practices become the standard, they tend to get worse practices because people blindly follow them.
Mm-hmm.
And stop improving them.
Yeah. And he built that bridge, between best practices and performance based.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We can oftentimes lean into like, this is a best practice. And I know it's a best practice to your point, Miriam, about, you know, it forces us to maybe not innovate as much, not be right. as creative, think outside the right. box, but we can lean into that. And this is what an organization wants. This is what the culture wants. It's, you know, you can kind of stand on that bedrock. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think we've seen that in our organization. I mean, so many of our listeners are instructional design, learning experience designers. But when we first started as a very small business, instructional designers do everything start to finish. You work with the client, the subject matter expert. You write the storyboard, you design it, then you sit down and you sit at your computer and you're working an articulate storyline or whatever, and then you publish it out and then you work with then you grow and you find that some people are great at certain parts of that and other people aren't, and you need to do things faster. So our best practices, again, had to evolve to now we have teams of people doing each stage of that process. Mm-hmm. That worked great for a while. Then you grow to the point where now, how are we going to track what's happening? And do we need other people to insert in the process? And oh, by the way, we found that this isn't working quite so well when you're managing 55 projects as mm-hmm. opposed to 10. And so, again, I think he's not advocating that there isn't like practices that are widely accepted based on science we should do, but that we always have that mindset of, well, let's be open to the fact that we might need to tweak this for this situation or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. All right, well, there's a lot more in this book to unpack, and we are not going to be able to do all of that today. What I wanted to just wrap up with is really two things. For you, Cade, and Jeff, any overall opinions, accolades, dissent, right? Like, what did you really love? Anything you're like, I'm not sure I agree with this yet. And then the last thing I'm going to ask you is if you could ask Adam Grant one question about his book, what would it be?
I can start. One of the things I pulled from it that I really liked or that stuck with me is passions are developed, not discovered. So the whole thing with what do you want to be when you grow
up?
We
didn't even touch on the last chapter, which is all about that, which is
it's excellent.
Honestly one of my favorite chapters. Yeah. So keep going. I interrupted.
No, it's just growing up is infinite. So at some point, you know, are you reaching an end where I'm a firefighter now? Like, are you done? So mm-hmm. It's more just learning is never done. Work should not define you. I just think the passions are developed, not discovered, is really cool.
Yeah, that was a great takeaway from that chapter.
Just to piggyback off that before, because I think you have some more after that, but I just recently I had one of my best friends, his name's Dave. Dave kind of made a pivot in his career where he said, you know, he has a doctorate degree in this one thing. He said, you know, I just have a different passion now. And I kind of want to go after that. And he's pursuing that. And it's just been a really cool thing to watch, you know, somebody move from a really successful, really yeah. lucrative career and just go like, that's not my passion anymore.
I had a friend literally do this 2 weeks ago. He was in financials, doing investments in Nashville and packed it up, moved to Hawaii, and is now living on a bean farm in Hawaii. And he's doing that for the next three months, just figuring it out. And then he's going to start his own company from there. But just kind of taking a step back and like, time to rethink what I like. And
it's their journey.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Well, and I think
I respect it.
I think COVID has forced a lot of people to do that. I think, so I'm sitting here, I'm in a very different age bracket than you guys are. So there's a small piece of my heart that's like, are you kidding? Like you have responsibilities and a mortgage. And
growing up is not finite.
I totally agree. On the other hand, I look at my life and there's numerous times where I pivoted and I think passions change, but also the work that you do can feed into what that next interest is. And often people, well, now I have this experience in this area. I'm interested in moving on to this area, but I take all that with me and it actually makes me better. Now I'm able to develop and work in this field or that field. So it's not, we're not necessarily arguing for moving to the bean farm, although that works for some people. For other people, they have to do that, right? Like, in a more gradual way. Like I keep my day job while we always talk about side gigs, right? Like I'm working on that to grow into something else. But again, that's all that process of rethinking all the time, which is really exciting.
Mm-hmm. Something, just the end thing, I think for me that I just really loved about this, it kind of, I'm just going to tell like a brief like vignette.
Please do.
You know, so if you're out hiking, you're backpacking and you're going down this mountain, you're going, you know, you're kind of doing switchbacks back and forth and you get to the bottom and the path just gets really narrow and you've got this big pack, you've got some on your hips, you're really, you have a lot on you, but the path becomes too narrow for you to actually pass through with everything on. So you have to unload your pack. You can only take some with you to get to the other end. And now you have to make the journey all the way back to your pack to grab again what you can fit through. And it's this, to me, that visual of this, that little like almost vignette story is this deconstruction of, man, I know where I think I want to get. I want to maybe rethink. I want to kind of get somewhere, but maybe I need to unpack all these beliefs that I have with me, all of this stuff that I've thought I held on to really tightly. I need to put it down. And you're only going to go back and pick up those things that are totally critical for the rest of your journey. You may only make two trips back and leave some back at the trailhead. Because it's just too, I'm just not going to burn my energy to take all that back through. So it's really this deconstructing all these things that we think we might hold on to really dearly and really just taking an inventory and audit of ourselves and going, is this really what I need? Is this the most critical thing for me to have on the other side of this really narrow pass to continue my journey forward? And so to me, this was just like such a great example of that kind of thing, helping me kind of think through and approach everything. What can I leave behind that's not totally critical for my journey forward?
Which you might not know either, because you have no idea what's in front of you. I mean, I think one of the things was Life is like driving at night in the fog. I don't know if that was in that book, but you can only see as far as your headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way, which is pretty cool because it's you're not sure what you need to leave behind or take, but having the ability to rethink it and go is the most important part.
Yep.
No, I love that. I love that vignette. And I think that's kind of the, I for myself personally, that process of, like, for example, parenting, like things you, when you had like a 1 year old and you're like, or if you don't have children, you see kids in the store in the restaurant, you're like, my kids would never do that. And then I'm like, I'm here to tell you they will. Or your animals, right? Your fur babies. I would never let them. And then you have them and you're like, or I would never do that in a relationship with a significant other. And then you do.
And then you do.
Right. And so I totally agree. Like, it's that process of life experience, looking back and be like, man, that was not that important. Like, my child didn't do this or that, or like, what, they are healthy, productive human beings or whatever the situation is. So I think that's really healthy, and a really, this book, if anything, just sort of, like you said, stirs that thinking in you and that passion. And kind of the only thing, and I don't think he's advocating for it, it'd be my question to Adam Grant is, are you saying that there's never any absolute truth and that, like, everything we believe is a constant shifting sand? And I don't think that he is, but that would be sort of either question slash, I don't want to say criticism, but like, there are some things I think at the end of the day we rethink. And like you said, we keep them in our pack. Then how do I relate to somebody that has a complete opposing view to something that I do hold dear and I am going to keep in my pack? But he really does provide, I think, some good examples and ways to still relate to them while not advocating that I'm just dumping everything I believe. Yeah. So anybody, what's a question you might have for him? We're gonna tag Adam Grant on social media. We'll see if he answers. I don't know. He's obviously wildly popular. So we'll see.
Well, I had one for... Grant, I would be curious if he were to write a follow-up, a sequel to this book, what would he prescribe or guide somebody in how to, once you might come to understanding with somebody else or with build a healthy work organization, where do you go from there?
Yeah.
Because there will inevitably, and maybe it's circular, I don't know, but like, where do we go from here? Because disagreement always arises,
right?
Conflict always arises, and you can tell a lot of stories with the same data. And what if we just can't get to alignment? Where do we go from there?
Which was really precisely my question, right? Like, there are going to be some things that people hold on as absolute to them, and it's bedrock belief. So now, what do I do? How do I interact with people knowing that we do have very complete different opinions on this? So, great question. I like how you framed it as a sequel. Like, what would we do next?
Yeah, maybe he's writing right now. Maybe.
Let's hope so.
Yeah. The agree to disagree book.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, thank you both for joining the podcast. This has really been a great discussion. I hope for you, our listeners, it's just whetted your appetite. Again, it is a beach read. You can read it, or you don't have to read it on the beach, obviously, but you can put as much or as little into it as you want, I think is what we're saying here. So thank you all for listening, though. Your time is a gift, and we're so appreciative that you spend it with us. If you're looking to interact more with us, you can find our posts on social media, MindSprings, and every time we release a new podcast. So we're looking forward to hearing from you. We'd love to do a Q&A session sometime pretty soon. So we're looking for some interaction on social media, and we really appreciate your time.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Learning Well podcast. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please leave some feedback on whatever platform you're streaming on. We'd really appreciate it. We'll see you in the next episode.